DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Vincent Ryan, who is an assistant professor of history at Aquinas College. With Dr. Ryan, we go inside the pages of The Maid of Orleans, The Life and Mysticism of Joan of Arc, written by Sven Stolpe and published by Ignatius Press. Vincent, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
The Maid of Orleans, The Life and Mysticism of Joan of Arc. It is a fascinating take on a tale that has been told in many different ways, hasn't it?
It has. Joan of Arc is certainly one of the more written about figures in history, certainly one of the most written about people during the Middle Ages, partially because I mean, she's so remarkable. But what adds, I think, to the mountain of books that seemingly there's no end to being produced is the fact that she's one of the best documented people of the medieval period due to the various trials that she experienced during her life. And then her posthumous rehabilitation trial was another environment where a lot of eyewitnesses about her life, family members came forward. So we know much more about her than even lots of, aristocrats and kings and queens because of all these legal proceedings that she was involved in.
Go ahead. Keep going.
Well, and with all that, I mean, so there's so much evidence and her voice, that we have direct access through the transcripts of these trials that that make her, on top of the remarkable things that she was involved in, the interest of people, whether they're religiously inclined or secularly inclined, she's remains really since her since she came onto the scene in 1429. Ever since then, she remains this figure of great fascination.
Many of the treatments of her life have, as you so beautifully kind of guided us through this forest in the introduction to the book, that many have tried to claim her for certain agendas. This particular book shines out because it goes right to the heart of her motivation, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a thing that I have to admit I was a little skeptical when I heard when they asked me if I was interested in doing an introduction. I wasn't really familiar with the book, and I thought, this is a reprinted book that, yet one more drop in the pile of Joan of Arc tomes that are out there. What really does this have to bring to the table? But when I read it, what I was really struck by was something that, and I've read, for better or worse, a fair amount of things on Joan over the years, was the way in which the author is able to use this idea of Joan's mysticism, her mystical spirituality, and the mystical nature of how she endured her sufferings as something that, that it was like, as you, these blinders are lifted from your eyes and you're seeing something that you've looked at all the time in this new perspective. And I think that's what's interesting. I've seen someone refer to it, I wanted to pass this line off as my own, but I can't. Talk about what he's doing is he takes Joan from the national, because of course, especially in the groups that claim her most in recent years are nationalist, French nationalist groups. But he talks about how Stolpe's work here, The Maid of Orleans, takes Joan from the national to the international, really by moving her beyond just the purview of French politics, the Hundred Years' War. I mean, these things are important to understand Joan's environment and milieu, but in providing this other lens to more properly appreciate her mission, how she operated, and that is by considering the sufferings that she endured and the spirit in which she took these on. He says it's almost like this. He talks at one time, it's like the repetition, Joan's suffering, the repetition, the redemptive suffering of Christ is almost how he views what she's enduring.
How interesting that this take would come from a Swedish convert.
Yeah, well, This book was, it's an interesting topic because, of course, I mean, even the notion of a Swedish convert to Catholicism, mm-hmm. Sweden along with the other Scandinavian countries, I mean, remains, Catholicism remains a very sparse religion up there. And, you know, Sven Stolpe, if you look into his biography a little bit, you see he's certainly, like many Europeans, a continental man, so he was not just out in Sweden all of his life. Clearly his studies in Western Europe, in Paris, spent some time in Oxford, and had an impact on him. And he wrote this book not long after his own conversion. So I think you can certainly, I mean, you don't have to know that, but if you know that, you can see, I think, all the more the joy and the zeal of a convert kind of infuse, you know, his own take and insight into Joan's own experiences there, which I think, again, adds this, you know, very interesting, different approach to the book that, in spite of it being, you know, produced more than 60 years ago, gives it this feeling of freshness, and adds something important to our understanding of Joan and to this larger conversation of who Joan was and what her impact was and what we can emulate from her. And I think that that's something that that is quite impressive, and that is, you know, Ignatius Press should be applauded for providing a wider forum for this book once more, and I hope plenty of people who are interested in Joan are able to take advantage of that.
Well, I also applaud Ignatius Press, Vincent, for having you as the person who wrote the introduction to the book, because like you, I've read many books on Joan, and none of them I have ever walked away with feeling satisfied. I don't know if that's, you know, a proper way of saying it, but I always...
No, I know what you mean. It's just, you know, the one thing I like about this is, because often with Joan books, what you get is either something that's kind of spiritually saccharine, mm-hmm. And so it's just, you know, it's kind of just, it's a little, at least from my perspective, a little too caked in a hagiography where it's hard to kind of penetrate and get at who Joan is, and it feels a little too removed. And then others, you get, you know, these, a lot of modern interpretations where Joan is bipolar, Joan is schizophrenic, and so mm-hmm. not even willing to kind of just look at Joan on her own terms in that way. And what Stolpe manages to do, at least for me, that again makes it stand out, is navigate between those two poles. You know, not just accept anything about Joan that's uttered, you know, in a hagiographical sense, and question some of these things and debunk some of these things, like the famous episode where Joan arrives at the Defense Court in Chinon and supposedly identifies him, having never seen him before, amid his courtiers. And Stolpe says, you know, this comes from a much later source. This doesn't seem very credible. This is kind of an example of how legends and, you know, of hagiography kind of get barnacled on to the historical person there. So you have him, you know, not wanting to just perpetuate any sort of story, no matter how pious, about Joan that's out there, even if it's been handed on and echoed many times in various works on Joan. But he's also not like, you know, others who just want to, like, look at Joan, strip away all the spiritual components and try and, you know, do some sort of psychohistory of Joan as well. You know, he's just trying to consider all these strands of Joan and look at her in this totality. And I, for one, certainly appreciate that. And I think it makes the book really stand above a lot of the books on Joan that are out there.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. Vincent Ryan about The Maid of Orleans, The Life and Mysticism of Joan of Arc, written by Sven Stolpe. It actually published originally in 1956 and didn't necessarily, as we've been discussing, there have been so many other books out there, but what was so wonderful about encountering this book, especially after the setup that you give us in the introduction, you can see, even though he can be skeptical at times in some of the approaches of things that maybe he didn't need to be so scrupulous about, but when he talks about her prayer life, and especially that beginning, that flowering of mysticism, he's very tender with all that, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's it's the sort of thing that I think gives real depth to his portrait of Joan, and you don't encounter even in a lot of biographies of Joan that take her spiritual persona seriously. The kind of nuance that he's kind of getting in there of trying to, you know, get at who she is, what she's talking about. I mean, here's a line that always a portion of his discussions about Joan's mysticism, Joan's spirituality that struck me particularly from the book that I just jotted down here. He says, "Joan's real greatness is her willingness to die as shameful a death as the Savior upon the cross. As a sacrifice for all the cowardly, the cold-hearted, and the arrogant, God must call upon the purest and bravest of souls to suffer innocently and to die." And the sections where he's talking about her imprisonment and her trial, I think, particularly get at what you're talking about, her prayer life. I mean, it's a theme throughout the book, a strand that he weaves throughout his study here. But of course, you know, in her isolation, in her persecution, in the sufferings she endured at her trial at Rouen, is when you really see, you know, Stolpe try and penetrate as much as he can into the spiritual side of Joan and how that was her bedrock, and how she embraced her suffering in overcoming such a hostile, challenging environment.
You also point out in the introduction, which was a good jumping off point for me, where he actually writes that the great fault was nearly with all previous accounts of Joan's life is that they have ignored or minimized the fact that her spiritual development was that of a typical mystic. Now, isn't that interesting when he uses the term
I never mystic. Thought of that. Right. Yeah, I never, that was something that jumped right out at me. And I thought, well, this is definitely, because when I started, you know, skimming the book and seeing, okay, what, you know, what's this about? And that, I thought, like, you know, wow, that's pretty compelling. I've never considered that before, but, you know, he puts that right out there, and that's really the thread that ties the whole study together there is, you know, Joan is a typical mystic. Many of us don't think of her that way, but I think Stolpe makes a very compelling case that this is a very reasonable, accurate way to perceive Joan, and it makes sense. I mean, when you really kind of consider this, you know, and I think it's the thing about Joan that helps back up what Stolpe is doing is that we have access to her voice in a sense that we don't typically have with others because of the transcripts at her trials where she's talking about her spiritual life and the voices and you know, her love of Christ and whatnot. That enables, you know, Stolpe's not just engaging in a lot of, you know, speculation here. I mean, he's looking at what she's saying and at times looking at what others, her contemporaries and her colleagues said about her, about what they experienced or saw with her in her. To be able to put together this portrait of Joan the Mystic that is a credible one because of the words of Joan being able to provide the foundations for that interpretation.
Yeah, there's moments throughout the whole story of actually quite little nuggets of spiritual direction that is worthy even of today. Those who, I think there's a moment in the book where she is being approached by townspeople as she's beginning to really become very well known as they're making these campaigns. And even though they haven't always been successful, the people start to want to be around her. And she's warned, be careful. Don't fall in love with the sound of your own voice. Essentially, I'm a paraphrasing, but...
Right. No, you're right. I like how you put that.
Yeah, there are many, many moments like that where she always has to run back to that prayer, and that gives her the fortitude to be able to persevere and be, you know, what is it that she always receives in that prayer? Go, daughter of God.
Yeah, when you consider, just, I mean, yeah, so Joan, when you think about it, Joan on the, in the public sphere, you know, as someone known to the wider world during her time, it's really a very short window. Mm-hmm. Her life itself wasn't a particularly long one, but her but her time as a public figure was especially brief. But she just bursts onto the scene, and people gravitate to her. They're drawn to her just by her very humble demeanor, her humble confidence, I think. It might seem like a contradiction, but she's confident in her mission, in the rightness of the cause, and that she's doing God's will. But she's not, there's no sense of haughtiness to her, by, you know, somehow I'm, you know, unique and wonderful by being selected for this, that there's just this humble confidence and determination that I think makes her all the more attractive to all those who are around her, who appreciate her, the more, that it inspires them either on the battlefield or to stand strong once more against the English, especially because, you know, when we think about this, France is in a pretty desperate situation. Joan is born in the environment of the Hundred Years' War, a war that had been going for quite some time when she's born, around 1412. It had overrun many parts of France. It was a type of war where we have these ideas of medieval warfare, I think, from Hollywood films, where, you know, everyone is in a big open field and they charge at each other. And occasionally those sorts of battles would happen, but they were rare. You know, most medieval warfare is very humdrum siege warfare around some castle. But for the Hundred Years' War, most of the warfare experience was raids by these mercenary groups and free companies that would trade sides between the English and the French, and they would ravage towns and villages and countryside. So it was a war that there was not this separation between the battlefield and non-combatants. It was a war that greatly devastated France and that very much impacted the average person in many of these villages, like the village of Domremy, where Joan grew up. So France had lost a great deal of its kingdom over the intervening decades of the Hundred Years' War. So when Joan comes on the scene, I mean, it's not, things have improved a little bit for France. The death of Henry V, immortalized in Shakespeare's play, had bought some breathing room for France when it looked on the precipice of total defeat. But it tells you how desperate the situation is, that when you think about it, this 17-year-old girl who's illiterate, she's a peasant, so she's not from an elite background, comes onto the scene and is able to present herself at the court as someone who God wants to help lead the French into battle to regain their lands and have the Dauphin crowned. And, you know, there was some skepticism about this. You know, after her visit to the Dauphin's court at Chinon, she undergoes like kind of a 3-week interview or investigation where theologians and others are, you know, having discussions with her to try and get a handle on her spiritual claims and see if they're orthodox. And she passes that. But still, the fact that they're willing to let a peasant teenage girl lead the army into battle. I mean, you know, she's not really making military decisions, but she's still there as someone who's kind of a standard bearer, motivating and inspiring the men in that way is pretty remarkable. And it shows you how desperate the situation was. That, now, granted, it's an age in the medieval period where religion permeates many more aspects of life than our modern age does, and so people are more willing to consider something that Joan was claiming than they might nowadays. But nonetheless, I mean, there was great skepticism that she encountered, even among those who eventually became her supporters. And you know, when you really kind of think about what she was doing and the background she came from and the fact that anybody's believed her and supported her and what she was able to achieve, it's really astonishing. It's astonishing. And Stolpe is certainly, you know, makes that clear as well. He wants to focus upon the spiritual persona of Joan, but he doesn't, you know, he provides good historical context for the environment in which these events are unfolding, that you know, give us a good context for Joan's life, and I think, you know, give us an appreciation, his primary goal, of her spirituality, but also a good appreciation of the wider impact of Joan on France itself. And you see it, like you noted, in these groups of people who are, you know, drawn to her. And of course, her successes, like at Orléans and Pathé, more and more groups, you know, are drawn to her and people want to meet her. And, you know, she's, you know, becomes, she's a celebrity. She's someone who they want to have contact with because their patriotic pride, their knowledge of her reputation for holiness, a variety of things. And through all of it, she remains quite humble. Again, she can be defiant at times for those who don't want to go along with the plan that she's promoting. You know, she gets frustrated with some of Charles's advisors with their, you know, decisions to want to emphasize negotiation a bit more. Joan, as it relates to campaigning, is certainly a woman of action. So that part of Joan always kind of amuses me. Joan is a little bit of a porcupine element, a little of a prickly personality when there are these debates in the war room about, you know, what's the next step here. But in spite of, you know, the great success she has, the thing that I think sticks out is that she's not overwhelmed by it. And I think, as you noted, and Stolpe likes to point out, her prayer life is the thing that keeps her grounded. And that's one of those things that highlights yet another element of the Maid of Orleans that the author does a really impressive job of kind of giving us some fresh understanding of.
It kept coming back to me over and over again that basis in which he was examining, the lens he was using, of the typical mystic. And when you look at that, even for Joan, the fact that she was such a contemplative, she had to go off on her own. She had to go into that prayer. That's how she originally experienced it, was in those times of essentially solitude in those younger years. Not right. Unlike other women, other typical mystics, Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, number of the others who did extraordinary things, even little Bernadette Subaru. I mean, when you really read the actual accounts written in her own hand and from other people who knew her at the time, I mean, they were, like you said, they could be prickly, but it was because they were so grounded in what they were experiencing every day, the surety of it all.
Yeah, Joan is, you know, when she, her, one of the big things that she was keen on emphasizing to the men in the armies that she led out was, you know, everyone make sure to go to confession before battle. It's important, you know, for your immortal soul, who knows what's going to happen to you on the battlefield. But so there's that concern, but also it's important for us to be in the proper, not just in the state of grace, but confession will help us put us in the proper state of mind of what we're doing and what we should be aspiring towards there. So, you know, Joan was an atypical commander in that way. You don't see a lot of commanders, past and present, emphasizing the sacramental life of the church as a necessary component of campaigning there. But again, that's one of the things where that really, again, elevated Joan above the typical experience. And the troops talk about how, you know, it's something where a lot of them hadn't gone to confession in a long time and were initially somewhat cynical about this, but they came to realize, even those who might have been skeptical or unsure about, you know, who this girl was and what she was about, the genuine nature of her piety and the very straightforward humble aura of confidence, love of Christ, love of country that was there, that, you know, collectively rallied the French people to dig themselves out of this very dire political situation they'd found themselves in the late 1420s.
It's just a fascinating read, and there's so much more. I mean, if you could talk to us briefly, too, about the need for that trial of rehabilitation.
It's a fascinating thing. I think a lot of people don't realize that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, the movies, you know, all the movies on Joan, never, there's no, it would probably not make a good movie where then you have a rehabilitation trial, the posthumous trial that happens nearly 30 years after her burning there. And so I think a lot of people who are even fairly well versed about Joan's life and her experiences either forget about or are not fully aware of this rehabilitation trial. So in the Hundred Years' War, Charles, you know, Charles is certainly a big act of ingratitude on this guy who Joan is able to, you know, is one of the few people who believes in him. And Joan ultimately enables him to be crowned at Reims as one of, again, her great successes there. And when she's captured by the Burgundians outside of Compiègne, Charles could have paid a ransom. I mean, the reality is these opportunities existed. This is how these conflicts were fought, if people would ransom important prisoners. But he doesn't. You know, it's almost like he feels like he's, you know, her usefulness has been used up to him. And I feel like he probably got a lot of criticism, and rightfully so, for this. So when the French forces are able to retake the city of Rouen around 1449, 1450, the city of Rouen was where Joan's heresy trial was and where she was burned at the stake. It provides the opportunity now for Charles to right his wrongs, if you will, give Joan the fair hearing that she never received. And so, some people look cynically at the rehabilitation trials, it's called, that happens in the 1450s, as just this political act. And there's a political component to it. Joan was an important component of the Valois dynasty's reputation. But there's no, you know, if you look at, you know, a really good book on the retrial is by the great French medievalist Régine Pernoud, her book on the retrial of Joan of Arc, I believe it's called. And she looks at this and she talks about this is not a kangaroo court, okay? In fact, it's quite the opposite of the dubious legal proceedings that Joan endured at Rouen that led to her burning at the stake as a heretic. What it is, it provides an environment for some of Joan's family members who are still alive, many others who knew her, and for a legitimate ecclesiastical proceeding to happen, authorized by the church to occur, and for the true nature of Joan. And again, it's primarily concerned not so much with her military feats, it's about Joan the believer. You know, what did she believe? Was she a heretic? I mean, clearly the verdict was no, and so the goal was to undo the unjust determination of the trial that led to her execution almost 30 years before. And so because of that, the rehabilitation trial was important in removing the moniker of heretic from Joan, but also it was invaluable in providing so much more insight into Joan. And again, it was very spiritually focused because the goal was to show the unjust nature of the heresy charges that were used to execute her there. So it's pretty fascinating reading. Stolpe gets into it a little bit, but even here, I mean, it's just almost like a postscript in his book. And it's something that I think is really important for us having an even fuller picture about Joan, and ultimately was a critical thing that was needed to pave the way towards her later canonization in the early 20th century.
I like the way he wrote also about her effect on the late 1800s in France, not only those Catholic intellectuals, but as we know, she would also touch even the simplest of hearts, like Thérèse the Little Flower.
Yeah, she's, I mean, this is one of the things, but clearly her appeal in France operates on many levels there. The political drapings of what she was doing makes her a figure that French politicians, past and present, like to connect themselves to kind of convey something to the electorate. But she's also very accessible as a saint. And sometimes people can feel like sometimes the saints are hard to get at. Some people will claim that. And Joan, not being someone who took, joined a convent, joined a religious order, led a unique life, but one that was, someone of a very simple background here. And I think it made her all the more remarkable and appealing. And this combination of, for certainly a lot of people, the patriotism that they felt about Joan and what she achieved, but also the spiritual grounding, which all this was rooted in, all her acts were rooted in, again, ultimately her love of Christ. And I think that's what Stolpe very nicely ties it all back to at the end of the day.
Well, Vincent, I wish we had more time, but any final thoughts?
I would just say that, you know, if you think you know all there is to know about Joan, you would be surprised if you take a look at the Maid of Orleans. And it will provide some different perspectives that I think if you have a thirst for learning more about Joan of Arc, that will be well rewarded.
Dr. Vincent Ryan, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
With Dr. Vincent Ryan, we've gone inside the pages of The Maid of Orleans, The Life and Mysticism of Joan of Arc, written by Sven Stolpe. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.